Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky joined in studio by author Doug Fain. Doug, let's just do a little more on some of the story or stories in the book. There's a section where a pilot goes down behind enemy lines. Tell us a little about that.
Well, the interesting thing about that particular part of the book to me is the case of this surgeon. And he's a rather small man, and he's one of the best surgeons in the world, and he's always been top in everything he does. And finally, he finds himself in the middle of a war, and he's about a 98-pound weakling, and he's surrounded by all these crazy, raucous pilots, and he doesn't fit in, and he won't go to the officers' club. He's madly in love with this other surgeon. He doesn't know how to tell her. He loves her because she's in love with one of the pilots, but he's madly in love with her. And when he's around her, he can hardly perform his operations or anything. And one of the situations in the book is when one of the pilots goes down behind enemy lines, and his story, Dick Leary's story, is an amazing story. He ends up being shot by enemy soldiers. He finally escapes, and he's lost his radio. And he's trying to find his navigator, who would have a radio so they could call in a helicopter and get picked up. And he finds his navigator hanging 30 feet off the ground in a tree, dead. He'd been shot. And his story that Dick goes through is really, I think, one of the more interesting parts of the book, of this man trying to survive when he's been badly shot, badly wounded, and he knows the radio is 30 feet above him, and he can't reach it, and he can't climb the tree. And there's an interesting story of how he finally gets the radio, and he's crawling out of the area. He's wounded so badly, and he can't walk. He's just crawling, and he wants to lay down and sleep. And as he crawls along, he keeps hearing his father's voice, and his father keeps saying, get up, Dick. You're a Leary. You don't quit. Get up. Keep going. And he keeps saying, okay, Dad, sure, Dad. And he crawls on and on. And finally, he gets out into this clearing. And he ends up, as he's crawling out, an enemy soldier is walking up the path, whistling, singing a song. And Dick is thinking to himself, don't come up here. Go away. Go somewhere else. Don't come here. And the man walks up, and Dick has no choice. He stands up and shoots him in the chest with a small caliber pistol that he had. And he walks over to finish the enemy soldier off. And when he looks in the man's eyes, he can't do it. And they look at each other. They're both two human beings who've been wounded, who've been hurt, and they're in pain. And he just turns away, throws the gun aside, and walks off into the edge of the jungle. In the meantime, they're coming to get him in this helicopter. And the story of all of the helicopter crew and what they go through, to make a long story short, it ends up that the female surgeon is going out to get on the helicopter, and the small doctor runs out and says, nope, his name is Philip. Philip says, no, Carrie, you can't go. I'm going. And she says, do you think I can't do this because I'm a woman? And he says, Carrie, this has nothing to do with your being a woman, but it has everything to do with my being a man. And she understands what he's saying, and she hands him the bag, and he flies out. Well, when they get there, the big guy in the back of the helicopter, who usually goes down to get the wounded guys, gets hit by ground fire. The co-pilot gets hit by ground fire, and only the pilot and this little tiny Philip, this doctor, are left. And as they're hovering above the jungle, the pilot says, I guess we'll go home. And Philip says, you can't. If you leave, he dies down there. He dies. And he says, you'd never be able to live with that, and neither would I. We've got to try. And the pilot says, well, what do you have in mind? And he says, I'm going down. And the pilot starts to laugh. And when he does, Philip gets angry. And he starts shouting at this pilot, and they're cursing each other a bit. And finally, the pilot says, have you ever hung on a cable with wind beating on you at 300 miles an hour and people shooting at you? And Philip says, not before today. Anyway, he goes down. He finally finds the pilot, who is unconscious. And he patches him up. And the helicopter is left to come back 15 minutes later. And while he's standing there, he hears the sound behind him. And he turns around and hears the enemy soldier who's wounded. Well, what does a doctor do? Philip runs over, gets down his hands and knees, and patches up the enemy soldier. And he looks, and he finally stands up and he looks at this guy and he says, "If they find you soon, you'll probably make it." And when he turns around, there are two enemy soldiers there with a rifle pointed at him. And he's totally shocked. He puts his hands up. He doesn't know what to do. But the old soldier walks over and talks to the enemy soldier on the ground. And he keeps looking at Philip with this funny look on his face. He keeps looking at the other guy. And finally, he goes over and he tells the young soldier with him to take the wounded man down to the village. And when he starts picking him up, Philip jumps over real quick and he helps him lift the wounded soldier up. And he puts the wounded soldier's arm around the young man's neck and he says, "Easy, easy." And the two of them go off down through the jungle with this young man, a young soldier helping the wounded man. And the old man is quite old and he's looking at Philip and they hear the helicopter coming. And as they do, he finally says, he just motions for Philip to go. And he points the gun at the ground and he motions for Philip to leave. Well, Philip is kind of shocked, but he finally figures this out and he walks over. He finally goes back over to Dick Leary. And when he gets there, Dick's 240 pounds. He can't pick him up. And he's on his hands and knees, and he's trying his best to lift this unconscious, wounded pilot. And tears are streaming down his face. He's so frustrated and so angry and so upset. And all of a sudden, an arm reaches over, and it's the old soldier. And he helps him lift the wounded pilot up, and he puts the arm around Philip. And he looks at him, and he says, "Easy, easy." And at the end of this, the two of them are going up on the winch. They're being winched up into the helicopter, and the old man nods to them and turns and walks into the jungle. Now, when they get back to the base, no one knows what Dick did on the ground. They only know he brought back Dick. Philip brought Dick back. And so when Carrie, the other surgeon, the female, comes up to him at the end, she says, "Did you find the man you were looking for?" And he said, "Yes, I did." And she said, "Can you live with him?" And he said, "Yes, I can." And she said, "That's wonderful. Let's go to the hooch, the little place they lived, and get a beer." And he says, "No, let's go to the club." Well, he would never go into the club in the past because he didn't fit in with these raucous pilots. When the two of them walk in the back of the officers' club, there's suddenly silence in the room. And the old Colonel Bennett stands up and looks at him, and he starts to applaud. And when he does, the entire room, all these pilots, start to applaud. And I wrote the rest of that chapter from Carrie's position, watching Philip's face. Mm-hmm. When finally he was one of the guys, he was one of the troops.
And I'm kind of stunned into silence here from that story, which is unusual for me. But how much of that is based on anything that you know, that not that happened to you necessarily, but that happened to anybody you know?
Well, almost all of the book is based either on things that happened or things that I've talked to other pilots that they've experienced, or things that were passed down through the common knowledge of what happened in that part of the world at that time. Now, granted, a lot of it is embellished. I mean, I'm writing a novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fiction novel. And so there's a lot in there that's embellished and some that's just pure fiction as well. But there were some interesting people. And some of there's a few stories in there that are exactly the way it happened.
So there, you mentioned to us earlier that there are a couple parts of the book that you can't read. I mean, can you give us a clue, like what parts of the book are that difficult for you, the guy who wrote the book?
Well, there's some. If you read the book, you'll know. Let me just say that.
Okay.
If you read the book, it will be very obvious what the real parts. There's a couple of them that are just difficult. One of them would be the parts with the children. I happen to have been the civic actions officer when I was there in Vietnam, I worked a lot with the local little villages and the children and things. And there are two children in this story that there's a really difficult part of the book there.
Yeah, I've read both in your executive summary and flipping through the book some of the sections that involve the children, and some of those are actually hard for one in particular was hard for me to read. So I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it's remarkable. Do you recall? I mean, we only have about 45 seconds left in this segment, but back when you wrote the first version of this in 1971, how long did it take you to write that?
Well, I was typing it on a Royal portable typewriter. I've often said, wouldn't it have been great if Shakespeare had had a computer? You know, he was very prodigious in his writings. He could have produced a lot more if he'd had a computer. I would say it probably took me probably 6-8 months. My second novel, The Draft, was written in 4 months. So I write quickly when I get started.
Well, when we come back after this break, Doug Fain, I want to ask you about other writing that you've done and other writing that you plan to do. So stay with us right here through this break on Backbone Radio. Again, Doug Fain, his book, The Phantoms Song, can be found on Amazon.com, and I certainly recommend that you do so. Stay with us right here. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. It's the Beat Farmers covering the Kinks' 20th Century Man. Love that song. Love both of those bands. Doug Fain, author of The Phantom Song, in studio with me. If I could just briefly again drift away from your book for a second. When you were talking about your personal experience, as well as basically what I think is the point of view of the some of the Americans in your book, it's this idea of fighting for others to be free. And it really fits in perfectly to this big national debate we're having now as we see all this stuff going on in the Middle East. Should we be involved in Libya? Should we get involved in Syria? What about Iraq and Afghanistan? And many Americans of all political stripes sort of wonder, you know, what level of sacrifice by America is acceptable to help others to be free. You know, is it how many American dollars is it worth? Is it worth any American lives? And you kind of implied, again, from your own experience, that you thought what you were doing in Vietnam was good and important because of the atrocities that were going on that you were trying to stop. And those who support our involvement, for example, in Libya, basically use that same argument. And yet, off the air, you told me that you're not at all sure, it's not obvious to you, at least, that being in Libya is a good idea. And I'll say, put it stronger for myself, that I don't think that Libya is worth one American life. And I'd love to get your perspective as a guy who's fought and nearly died to help other people be free. How do you view today's conversation?
Well, one of the things I think is kind of interesting, there are some parallels with Vietnam. There were a lot of us who went to Vietnam as career officers. I'd gone to the Air Force Academy. After the academy, I went to Georgetown, got a graduate degree in economics, and then went to pilot training and then to Vietnam. And I felt like we were doing the right thing. I came back from Vietnam and put in my papers and resigned. I got a call from the Pentagon, and they said, "We're looking at your records. Distinguished Flying Cross for heroism, a lot of DFCs for achievement, but not very many for heroism. Your career is set. Why are you doing this?" The reason, there were several reasons. First of all, I married a wonderful woman, beautiful. She was an Army nurse, by the way, when I first married her. And I believed in what we were doing, but when I came back, I felt that our government had let us down. I felt like they didn't want to win in Vietnam. If there's anybody who thinks that America could not have won a war with Vietnam, they need to go get their head examined. We could have won that war anytime we wanted. There were so many rules of war that people didn't understand. Here's one, for example. If we would fly over Kep Airfield and the MiGs would be parked on the apron, and we'd fly over them with F-4s loaded with rockets and bombs and Gatling guns, but we could not shoot at them on the ground. If they were in the air and had their gear and flaps down on final approach, you could not shoot at them. The only time you could shoot at a MiG was when the gear and flaps are up and they're in the air. If they're on the ground, they're off limits. The rules of war were set by Americans, by our government. And I think there are a lot of us who lost a lot of very good friends in that war who came back and said, you know, I don't mind fighting for my country if they want to win. And I think that one of the questions we have to ask ourselves today, as we should have then, was, what are we here for? Are we here to win? Are we here to lose? Are we here to just draw and break even? And my own personal opinion was, if we're here to win, count me in every time. But if you're here to lose, I'm sorry. I'm not willing to lose my life or have my friends lose theirs. If a group of politicians who don't have a clue about combat and don't have a clue about war are making decisions and putting our troops in harm's way, and when they're doing it for political reasons, I'm sorry, that's not something I want a part of.
So do you feel like that lack of interest in winning is being repeated in Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya?
It's a very different war there. We're not in fighting a war against an enemy that we can clearly define and go win. I think the problem we have is I don't think we know what we're there doing. If you wanted to help the rebels win in Libya, if that were indeed the idea, then they surely blew that. They didn't do that very well. If your idea was to help Gaddafi, well, they didn't do that very well. I'm not really sure what our plans are for that part of the world. And I'm not sure the government has done a very good job of establishing. This is the same problem we've had in Vietnam, same problem we've had in so many places. Somebody needs to have somebody in the political arena, the president, needs to have a pretty darn good idea of what the role is we're going to play, what we're going to do, tell the military, this is what I want you to do, and then get out of the way and let them do it. And if you're flying over Delta 17 in North Vietnam, and you see two tanks headed south, and you have to get on your radio and call a sector controller and say, I've got two tanks headed south. I'd like to drop bombs on them. They're going down there to shoot at our troops. And the sector controller says, well, let me call the southern controller, who then says, let me call Saigon. And the guy in Saigon says, well, let me call Hawaii, Hickam. And the guy at Hickam says, I'll call Andrews. And the guy at Andrews says, I'll call the Pentagon. The Pentagon says, we'll call the president and we'll get Johnson out of bed to make a decision. And by that time, I'm back in the officer's club drinking beer because I've run out of gas by now. If that's the way you're going to fight a war, a lot of us military guys said that's probably enough for us. We did the job we were called to do, but the politicians have a very important role in the American military. They decide how it's done.
Yeah, as you tell the story, I mean, I'm just sitting here shaking my head, which obviously radio listeners can't see. But what a remarkable experience you've had, and I think your perspective is invaluable. And I wish there were more people like you advising our current president. And we have a president who has spent his whole lifetime actually or figuratively voting present, and he doesn't have a clue.
I can tell you without a doubt, there's very little chance he'll ever have me as an advisor. I don't think he'll be calling me tomorrow.
Well, that says good things about you. Thank you so much, Doug Fain, for being in studio with me. Again, Doug's book, The Phantoms Song. And Doug will have more books coming out as well. I'm sorry we didn't get time to talk about that, but I'll put some stuff on my website about anything you do in the future and be happy to have you back in studio again as well. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me here. I really appreciate it.
So until next week, I wish you all, from all of us here at Backbone Radio, a happy, healthy, and prosperous coming week. Be well. Until then, this is Ross Kaminsky signing off for Backbone Radio.